Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Eat Better podcast with myself, Tommy Wood of drragnar.com and Chloe Archard of paleobritain.co.uk. Hello, Chloe.
Hi.
Hi. So today we have another guest on the podcast. Really excited about this one. We have Dr. Axel Sigurdsson, who runs the website docsopinion.com. He's a cardiologist in Iceland and has been writing and blogging about particularly heart disease and how we can look at both the tests and other ways that we can sort of manage our risk of heart disease, such as with statins or lifestyle or other potential measures. Hi, Axel. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hi. Nice to be with you.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's a huge pleasure to have you. But why don't you just briefly tell us about the work that you've been doing, because you've been doing this for, you know, a while before all this stuff about diet and heart disease sort of came into the forefront in the last sort of couple of years. So tell us about the work that you've been doing up until now.
Okay, I do consider myself to be mainly a clinical cardiologist. So I've been basically all my professional life, I've been working with patients. I've been doing some research as well. And to tell you the truth, in the beginning of my cardiology career, I wasn't really that interested in lifestyle issues. I found it took time, and I didn't see any immediate results. So as a young cardiologist, I was much more interested in what was happening in the ER and taking care of very sick patients, and I was interested in diagnostics and treatment. It wasn't until later on that prevention came to be very interesting for me. And so it's probably for the last 10 years I've been more and more interested in cardiovascular prevention and what we can do to limit the burden of this disease in our community.
And how long have you been running your blog for?
My blog has been running, it's a little bit more than 3 years now. Okay. I've been doing, before that I did some blogging in Iceland, mm-hmm. Mainly on, actually I started by writing small short articles on the internet for my patients. Because I found that all the brochures and everything we had were very old-fashioned, and I wanted to get them something fresh to read. So that's how it started, basically. And that was my Icelandic website, which came a little bit before Doc's Opinion.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I think everybody would be very keen to sort of hear about the whole gamut of lipid testing and dietary factors that or lifestyle factors that can sort of affect heart disease risk. So we've got questions as usual. I think Chloe will just sort of get started and we'll see what we get to.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on. We're really pleased to have you on, and I'll get straight into questions. So the first question was, I was just looking on a website in the UK, which is heartuk.org.uk, a charity with advice for people, and it says on this website, 6 out of every 10 UK adults have raised cholesterol. Having a cholesterol test is the only way you'll know if you're one of them. And it then says what a cholesterol test in the UK will tell you. It will give you total cholesterol, which needs to be 5 millimoles per litre or less, HDL of 1 or more, LDL of 3 or less, and fasting triglycerides of 2 or less. So maybe you could start by just explaining what those values actually mean and what can they actually tell somebody about their risk of heart disease.
Okay, thank you, Chloe. That's I found this quite interesting because if you say that, did you say 60% then have cholesterol levels that are too high?
according to sort of our standard in the UK.
Okay, and they're probably looking at the reference value of 5.0, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think this is a very, in my mind, a controversial statement, because we really don't know what's the optimal cholesterol. It may depend on many things. It may depend on whether you're a man or a woman. It may depend on how old you are and things like that. And by saying that there is a certain optimal level of total cholesterol, you're probably looking at cardiovascular disease. There are some other diseases that are related to cholesterol in a different way. And if you look at the mortality curves, when you look at total mortality in relation to total cholesterol, you will see a U-shaped curve. So mortality is raised among those with the highest level, and it's also raised among those with the lowest level. So too low and too high, neither is good. So you, basically the optimal level would be somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at total mortality, the curve looks a little bit different. If you look at cardiovascular mortality, then high levels of cholesterol become more important.
Mm-hmm.
So Axel, do you have a range for that when you're talking about high or low being too much? What I'm thinking of specifically is the Norwegian Hunt 2 study as one example, where they show that for women there's probably, or at least they didn't find an upper limit where more cholesterol was bad, but for men, so it looked like the ideal range was probably somewhere between 5 and 7. Is that for total cholesterol, is that kind of the range you're talking about, or do you have different numbers?
I often when I discuss these things with my patients, it's going to be a little bit different depending on, are you talking to a completely healthy person or somebody with cardiovascular disease? So I think we should, while we're in the current discussion, we should probably focus on the healthy individual, right? Because there are other things to consider when you have a patient with cardiovascular disease. I don't know, we might have some time to discuss that later on. But I often say to people who come to me for risk assessment that a cholesterol level below 6 is probably quite good in terms of cardiovascular risk.
Okay.
Between 6 and 7 is a bit of a gray area. It's probably nothing to worry about, and above 7 would be too high. So now I'm talking as a typical mainstream cardiologist. This is, but there are of course we could go on discussing those numbers forever, but this is usually what I say to my patients.
Okay. So, but if you're looking at, so say you're the average person, and maybe they've got into their 60s or something, and they've gone to their doctor has done a lipid test or a cholesterol test, and they don't have any overt heart disease, they don't have any angina or chest pain when they exercise, anything like that. And so they've got these numbers back. Apart from the total cholesterol number, we were originally told that LDL cholesterol is the bad cholesterol and HDL cholesterol is the good cholesterol. Do you think that that's, valid, or is there anything useful from those numbers, including triglycerides or anything like that?
As we started by talking about total cholesterol, we could end that discussion by saying that it's probably not very helpful to look at total cholesterol.
Okay.
So I don't really do that very often in the clinical setting. We look at the number, but I do not focus on it very much.
Yeah.
Then if we're coming back to LDL. Okay, we could the subfractions of cholesterol, the ones we call good and bad cholesterol. Everybody knows about that. The I think there is a number that you can use, which is which can predict cardiovascular risk very strongly, and it is related to it is more strongly, probably more strongly related to risk than LDL cholesterol, and that is non-HDL cholesterol. Non-HDL cholesterol is basically total cholesterol minus HDL cholesterol, and by doing this, you have a number which represents all the atherogenic lipoproteins. You've just subtracted HDL, which is not atherogenic. Mm-hmm. I do have a rule of thumb when it comes to non-HDL cholesterol, and that is above 5 is probably too high. This is a bit simplified, but above 5 is probably too high. Between 4 and 5 is the gray area, and lower than 4 is good. But then, if we know that for decades, LDL cholesterol has been what we have targeted all the time. We've known that for many years, that there is a strong correlation between LDL cholesterol and risk of cardiovascular events. LDL has been the, when it comes to cardiovascular prevention and lipids, in the traditional setting, LDL cholesterol has been and still is our main target. And that is what most cardiologists look at. The problem with there are actually many problems with LDL cholesterol. Firstly, it is a calculated variable. So there's a formula. You have to use a formula to calculate it. It's not measured in the routine setting. And what you basically do is that you take total cholesterol minus HDL cholesterol, and then triglycerides divided by 2.2. And then you get a number which is calculated LDL cholesterol. And this is a little bit tricky because, for example, if triglycerides are very high, the formula and then you will get a very, you will get a false low LDL cholesterol. Mm-hmm. As a clinical cardiologist, I'm very used to looking at LDL cholesterol, and if you look at the clinical guidelines, both the in the US and the European and the UK guidelines, LDL is usually the main target. Interestingly, though, last year when the or a little bit more than a year ago, maybe when the UK NICE guidelines were presented, they had non-HDL cholesterol as the main target. What is also good with non-HDL cholesterol is that you don't need a fasting blood sample. If you're going to use the LDL cholesterol, you will need a fasting blood sample because of the triglycerides, which are used in the calculation. Mm-hmm. So that's LDL cholesterol, and it's a number that is used by many cardiologists all over the world to calculate risk.
So, what people are starting to talk about more and more are the multiple different lipoproteins associated with different types of cholesterol, and including all the subfractions of LDL, so like LDL particle or small dense LDL, which is very difficult to get, which we think are probably more predictive of heart disease risk than, say, LDL itself, because it has many issues with it, like you suggested. But then it's very difficult for somebody in the UK to get an LDL particle measurement. So what I've heard a lot of people talk about is a ratio of triglycerides to HDL as a predictor of LDL particle number, and that maybe that would be a good indicator of heart disease risk. Is that something you look at, or something that you think is beneficial?
Yes, absolutely. I think the triglyceride HDL cholesterol ratio is very important, and it can actually tell you very much. As you said, Tommy, there are studies showing a relation between this ratio and the number of small LDL particles. That is, a high triglyceride HDL cholesterol ratio is associated with a high number of small LDL particles, and small LDL particles are very strongly associated with risk. And usually, if you have a high number of small LDL particles, you usually also have a high number of the total number of LDL particles will also be high. There is a variable that you can measure. It's mostly done in the US. I don't do it in my clinical practice. We don't have access to it, and that is the LDL particle number, which is very strongly associated with risk. And in most individuals, there is a correlation between LDL particle number and LDL cholesterol. Okay. But there are outliers on both sides. So you can have high LDL particle number and low LDL cholesterol. That's something that has been called discordance. So there may be, we know that some patients actually have a heart attack or a myocardial infarction, but they have low levels of LDL cholesterol. They might actually then have high levels, high LDL particle number. But coming back to the triglyceride HDL ratio, it can actually predict, a high ratio can predict high number of small particles, high total LDL particle number. And one more thing which is interesting, and that is, it's also a predictor of insulin resistance, which actually we are having a hard time to measure in the clinical setting, because there are no easily performed test to measure insulin resistance. But actually the triglyceride HDL cholesterol ratio may tell you about insulin. If you have an elevated ratio, you're more likely to have insulin resistance.
And I think that's quite a lot that you can potentially get from a very simple test.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was particularly interesting, because I think I've seen a lot of studies now which suggest that depending on your fasting insulin levels, so if you have high levels of insulin all the time, that is a very strong determinant of your risk of heart disease. So I think one particular study is the Quebec cardiovascular study, which was done almost 20 years ago now, and they showed that if your fasting insulin was less than 12, which is actually 12 is actually fairly high for a normal person, but if it was less than 12, then a lot of other things like your cholesterol level or your triglyceride level didn't really matter that much in your heart disease risk. So do you have, or do you measure fasting insulin? Do you think that's an important marker?
I think it could be, but we really don't use it in the clinical setting. Actually, we haven't done much of it so far, but sometimes actually I do measure it, not really to predict cardiovascular risk. But it is interesting to we know because of the obesity epidemic, we are seeing a very high fraction of the adult population is fulfills the criteria for the metabolic syndrome, and individuals with metabolic syndrome have a specific lipid profile. They usually have low HDL cholesterol. They have high triglycerides, and their LDL cholesterol may often be very low, or not very high. So LDL cholesterol in patients with the metabolic syndrome should be used with caution in my mind, because it doesn't really tell you much about risk. In these people, it is in my opinion, it's much more helpful to look at the triglyceride HDL cholesterol ratio. I think there are a lot of pitfalls in using LDL cholesterol to assess risk, and that is very well reflected in this rapidly growing population of people with the metabolic syndrome.
And these are the people where LDL cholesterol is being used the most, I guess, as a marker for future heart disease risk.
Yeah, that's right. It's still being used as the main marker. I believe it can be quite misleading.
Interesting. I had one more question about tests before we move on to sort of what we can actually do about this ourselves. And that's, like you say, that so you're obviously working in Iceland, and most of the people listening to this are based in the UK, and we don't have access to all the tests that they do in the US. And so if you're somebody that's interested in this kind of stuff and you're reading things or listening to podcasts, you will hear all kinds of different tests that people are having, you know, like lipoprotein, little a, ApoB 100. We talked about LDL particle, LPPLA2, small dense LDL, CRP, homocysteine. These aren't really things that we have access to, but do you think that there's any of them that maybe we should be testing that are maybe a better marker that you would ideally use if you had access to it?
I think some of them may be of practical use, like the LDLP number, for example. The ApoB 100 basically tells you the same. Apolipoprotein B reflects the particle number. Lipoprotein A is a tricky lipoprotein. It's very strongly associated with risk, but it's very difficult to lower it by any measure. It's probably mainly decided by genetic factors. Lipoprotein A down by diet is very difficult. Statins, for example, which are the most frequently used cholesterol-lowering drugs, they don't lower LPA. But the forthcoming PCSK9 inhibitors that are now being tested in big, very large clinical trials, they actually lower LPA about 30%. So they might be helpful in that respect. But the question is, what will be the clinical implications of lowering LPA? We still don't know that. The other things you mentioned, like homocysteine, for example, we don't use it in our clinical setting. But what I would find useful, we are using exactly the same test as you do in the UK. I would really like to have access to a test that you could tell you something about the particle number, something like LDLP or ApoB. I think that might be useful.
Okay. I think that that's probably... Chloe, do you have any more questions about testing?
Sorry. I just wanted to ask about the... So you were talking about the triglyceride and HDL ratio being quite useful. But what does that actually tell you? So once you've got someone's ratio and you can sort of translate that into a risk, in the UK we keep hearing that the level for statins to be prescribed to people is going to be lowered to anyone that has a 10% risk. I think it's a 10% risk, Tommy, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
What does that actually mean? If you're told you've got a 10% risk, of, is that something to be worried about, or is that going to be a lot of people are going to fall into that category? Because that's what I think sometimes it's hard to understand what the cholesterol test tells you as well in terms of really what your real risk is of, do you really need to have a statin, or are you, I don't know, just if you can explain what the risk means.
Yeah, I think that's... thanks for bringing it up, Chloe, because these are actually issues that I've been thinking about quite a lot lately, and we've been, me and my colleagues have been discussing these issues for many months now, because as you said, if you have a predicted risk of 10% of having a cardiovascular event in the next 10 years, your doctor should suggest statin treatment. And this number is actually lower than the US. In the most recent AHA and ACC guidelines, this number is 7.5%. But how do you calculate this risk? And actually there are specific risk calculators that can do that. Everybody can find these calculators on the internet. The UK has one, and the US has one. And if you find the calculator, put in your numbers. You put in your age, and keep in mind that it's not only cholesterol. You put you have to put in all the risk factors. So you're going to be asked about your age. Whether you're a male or a female, and then you're going to be asked about your systolic blood pressure, and whether you smoke or not, whether there's a family history of cardiovascular disease, and so on. And then when you've done that, you will get your calculated risk by pushing the button. You will get a number, that is basically how it's done. And there are actually different methods that have been used to create these calculators. And what I've found to be most problematic with them is everybody's going to end up with a statin as they age.
Mm-hmm.
So if I put in my numbers, I'm 56 years old. If I put in my numbers, I will get a risk in the UK calculator. If I put my numbers in there, I will get a predicted risk of 7.5% or something.
Mm-hmm.
So a UK doctor wouldn't have to suggest a statin for me. But if I don't change anything in the numbers I put in except my age, and I write my age and I say 61, then my calculated risk is suddenly 10.5%. So at the age of 61, if nothing changes in my lipid profile and risk factors in general, I'm going to end up having a statin just because I will get older.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a tricky thing, because do we really need to put everybody on a statin just because he's getting older? So we will end up with a very high number of people over the age of 70, which are on statin treatment if we follow the guidelines. But there's also something that we have to keep in mind, because the guidelines basically tell the doctors that they should inform their patients about what statins can do for them. So it should be shared decision making.
Mm-hmm.
You should educate your patient, tell him or her about the pros and cons of statin therapy, and then you will decide together what to do. So it's not like your doctor is supposed to write a prescription whenever he has a patient with calculated risk about 10%. And that's very important, because I think many doctors actually do that. They write a prescription. Here's a drug that can lower your risk by some percent, depending on whether it's using relative or absolute risk or anything. That's the easiest way for the doctor. Educating the patient takes a bit more time.
So I think it might be, I think it's probably different in Iceland, but there's an interesting thing that GPs have in the UK, which is targets for various things. So it could be targeting blood pressure in people over a certain age. And one of those will be in people who have what's been decided to be a high cholesterol level, they will have a target to get a certain number of those on cholesterol-lowering medication, and that is part of the way that they get paid. So mm-hmm. It's not just that it's easy for them to prescribe a statin, it's almost that if somebody gives them a level which they're told is high, then if they have a patient that's above that level, say it's 5, and they're over 65 maybe, then they will have a target to get a certain proportion of those patients on statins. So it's actually, you know, if they don't prescribe statins, it's actually stopping them getting paid.
Okay, so they will get reimbursed for it then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's not anything that we have in Iceland. No, absolutely not.
I thought it was interesting that you mentioned, obviously, say over 70 is an age where people will start to get... well, you dramatically increase the statin prescription rate if we're going off calculators. And obviously, everybody has to die of something. But what I think, or at least what I've seen, is that and this is obviously all observational, or most of it's observational data, but as you get older, so say above 70, as cholesterol levels come down, you have an increased risk of things like dementia, or an increased risk of all-cause mortality. So do you think that there's a certain age where, you know, statins really aren't worth it?
I do believe that's highly likely. I think there must be a certain age when statins will bring more problems, absolutely, and old people are very often taking a lot of medication.
Yeah,
and there is a high risk that there are many other medications that interact with statins in a way that may be harmful, and we're still learning about that, and it has actually come as a surprise in the last 3 or 4 years. We've been learning about commonly used medications that interact with statins and can cause problems and increase the risk of harmful side effects. And as you said, I think the issue with cognitive function and cognitive decline being caused by statins is far from resolved, and it hasn't really been addressed in any clinical study, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting also, because this discussion actually came up just a couple of weeks ago during the big cardiology the ACC meeting in the US when they were presenting data from the PCSK9 trials, which have been ongoing. And you know, the PCSK9 inhibitors are basically the new era of cholesterol lowering drugs. They are very effective. They are monoclonal antibodies that can be administered by subcutaneous injection.
So maybe. That's an injection just under the skin.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And so the patient can inject himself by a pen just under the skin, like some people do with the insulin. And the medication doesn't have to be, it's injected basically every 4 weeks or something like that. So it's quite simple, and in that way it's attractive. What I was going to say is that exactly this discussion came up at the ACC meeting, because there were some data suggesting that cognitive decline might be a problem with these new drugs, and that I know the FDA will be watching this very carefully.
Okay. What I wanted to, hopefully we'll have some time to talk a bit more about statins and other things at the end, but what I think both Chloe and I and the listeners will hopefully want to know is what you can do about your heart disease risk with lifestyle measures, so diet or exercise or anything else. And are there things that you particularly focus on? So say in patients who have some kind of cardiovascular disease, so maybe they just have angina, or you know, even all the way up to having had a heart attack previously, is there something that, or is there anything that you recommend to people, or anything that people could do that you think will have the biggest effect in terms of reducing their long-term risk of dying of a heart attack?
Yeah, I think we can basically approach this question in the same way for people with or without heart disease.
Okay.
I think it's the same principles, actually. And of course, much of what we know in this field is based on epidemiological observational studies, so which always is a problem. But if you consistently have observational data pointing in a certain direction, it has to mean something. So I don't think we can really ignore observational data. But okay, let's get back to the practical issues. I think exercise is extremely important. There is very strong evidence that regular physical exercise can reduce risk of heart disease. It's observational, of course, but it's very strong. And you don't have to exercise very much or heavily to benefit in terms of risk. Regular walking, for example, walking for 50, 60 minutes four times a week and getting your heartbeat up a little bit and a little bit of sweat. If you do that on a regular basis, there is certainly evidence that suggests it will reduce your risk. And of course, you can jog, you can swim, you can run or whatever, but to gain the biggest benefit in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk, you don't need heavy exercise. That's important. How about diet then? Of course, during my initial years as a clinical cardiologist, it was actually very simple. I usually recommended patients with heart disease to stay away from, to lower their intake of fat, in particular saturated fat. Mm-hmm. That was our main message for many years. Things have been changing for the last 5 or 10 years, actually. And I think it's important to understand as well that maybe we cannot give certain recommendations that apply to everybody. Maybe a 20-year-old university student who exercises on a regular basis is not, it has a normal body mass index, is very healthy, but maybe has a family history of heart disease. He may need completely different guidelines regarding diet than somebody who's 45 years old with a metabolic syndrome. What I have learned in the last 10 years or so is that dietary recommendations have to be tailored to the need of the patient. There are situations still when I would recommend somebody to reduce the intake of saturated fat, but that's not very common today, actually.
Is that, say, somebody with like an APOE4 genotype? Is it that kind of patient?
Yeah, and somebody with very high, where you really consider LDL cholesterol, or when you consider LDL cholesterol to be a real problem, and you consider it very important to lower it, that might exactly be somebody, as you said, with familial hypercholesterolemia, for example. And I usually recommend my patients, or in primary prevention as well. There are a few points I would like to mention, and the maybe number one is limiting added sugars. That's usually something I put number one. Mm-hmm. In particularly in for individuals with metabolic syndrome, young thin people who exercise a lot, they can usually eat sugar without problem. But I do consider added sugars to be a real problem in our diet today. So I usually put that high on my list, if my patients ask what can I eat, I usually tell them you should eat a lot of vegetables, you can eat fruit, and you can eat fish. So basically, eat as much as you can of these three. Of course, if you have diabetes or something like that, you may have to be careful with all the apples and bananas and oranges. Then I usually recommend my patients to try to avoid refined food products like refined meat and things like that. Try to choose fresh things like fish, meat. I don't think meat is a problem. Of course, there are some you know much more about that, Tommy, than I do. I think moderation is something we should think about when it comes to red meat. But I usually don't recommend my patients to stay away from it. When it comes to the largely growing population with the metabolic syndrome, I tend to go for carbohydrate restriction. I think that's the most logical and most helpful approach.
Yeah.
Considering how common the metabolic syndrome is becoming, it's becoming more and more often that I do recommend carbohydrate restriction.
And have you seen benefit in your patients? Are they losing weight, or are their numbers improving on if they do actually adhere to like carbohydrate restriction?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people benefit from it. As always, with we're all human beings, so people often have a problem sticking with it.
Mm-hmm.
But if they do, they will usually see results in terms of weight reduction, improved improved metabolic numbers, like their glycated hemoglobin will go down, and they will improve their sugar metabolism, and they will improve important fractions of their lipids as well, as we talked about before, like the triglyceride HDL ratio is going to respond very well to a low carbohydrate diet. There has been many of my colleagues have been worried about the impact that carbohydrate restriction may have on LDL cholesterol, because if you restrict carbohydrates, you will have to increase your intake of fat, and you should do that, because otherwise you will you won't get the energy you need. So, So carbohydrate restriction should include increasing fat intake, but of course you can choose. You can choose your fats. Yeah, there are. That's very important. So fat is not a bad word. It used to be, and it still is in some areas. But we have to understand that fat is a good word. But if you eat a lot of animal fat and dairy fat, your LDL cholesterol might actually go up, but your HDL cholesterol will probably go up as well. So the your total cholesterol will probably increase. It's very important, however, to understand that how lipids respond to low carb, high fat diets is very individual. It varies a lot. I've seen LDL cholesterol go down dramatically on a low carb high fat diet, and I have seen it go up to extremely high levels as well. So it's a tricky thing, actually.
And I think even though people's intake of fat will dramatically go up, I think one of the things that usually goes down, or can, you know, very predictably go down, is usually the triglyceride level, which is a fat level in the blood, but that usually goes down quite significantly with carbohydrate restriction.
Yeah, absolutely. And so as I said, the triglyceride HDL ratio will drop dramatically, which is which basically reflects the decreased insulin resistance as well. So I think this approach is indeed very helpful in the clinical setting, but the mainstream cardiologist and the mainstream doctor is still having a bit of a problem with accepting it, because it goes against stuff that we learned in the beginning.
Great. Chloe, do you have any more questions about the lifestyle aspects?
Just what do you tell your patients about stress, because that's obviously becoming something that is discussed more, and obviously I guess it plays quite a big role in heart disease.
Absolutely, Chloe, you're absolutely right, and there is a lot of observational data suggesting that actually that stress is a strong risk factor. It's hard to measure, but the but we have a lot of evidence from studies showing that in stressful situations like earthquakes and the 9/11 catastrophe a while back, we saw then that the incidence of heart attacks in the region increased, and there is a lot of data showing that work-related stress marriage-related stress and things like that are associated with increased risk of heart disease. Mm-hmm. So it's very important. The question is how can we measure stress, and how can we help people where we believe that stress is a problem. It's not an easy task.
No.
Do you have any specific recommendations, or is it just something you tell your patients to sort of avoid if they can? Obviously, because it is so difficult to measure or introduce any kind of, you know, people have to deal with the families they have and the marriages they have and the work that exactly. They have and all of that.
That's why it is so difficult. But I try to educate my patients about it and help them understand that it can make an impact. You'll have to educate your patients about what stress is and how it can be avoided and things like that. But the education is the key thing. We sometimes talk about stressors. A stressor is a thing that causes stress. And it can be so many things. It can be, as I said, it can be work-related, marriage-related. It can be financial. But I think educating people about it should make it easy for them to avoid it. And, of course, there are ways to relax. Just go out for a walk or a jogging or swimming or yoga or something like that will help you relax.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have we got time to talk about statins or are we out?
I think we'll just because we had, so Axel, obviously in the kind of group of people that listen to this podcast, there's a lot of controversy about statins. And I think there's a huge number of potential negative effects that are coming out fairly frequently. And a lot of it is to do with the metabolic pathways that statins are involved in. So it interferes with the production of coenzyme Q10, which is obviously very important for mitochondrial function, and potentially also vitamin K2, which is important for making sure your body doesn't put calcium in your arteries, which is obviously one of the key steps in heart disease. And I'll put some kind of studies and things in the show notes. But what I'd be interested in from your perspective, obviously, because you have this big overview about what dietary factors are important, what blood tests are and aren't important, and that's very different from a conventional cardiologist's point of view. So what I'd be interested to know is what patient do you think would maybe benefit from, like, who do you prescribe statins for and why and what benefits do you see?
I think it's, if you think about it a little bit, there's a biologic pathway in the body that you have discovered, and then you discover a drug that is able to block this pathway, would it be logical to think that blocking this biological pathway that has taken how many thousands of years to evolve, would it be logical to believe that blocking it would only have positive implications? Mm-hmm. It would probably be very naive to believe so. But we believed that in the beginning with the statins. When the first trial came on the effect of statins in secondary prevention, like the 4S trial, the results were very impressive.
And just, sorry, quickly to clarify, secondary prevention, you mean this is people who have already had a heart attack and you're giving a statin to prevent further problems?
Yeah. The first data we had on the use of statins in these patients were very strong in favor of statins. And the clinical trials, didn't really show, the placebo-controlled clinical trials didn't really show that much side effects, which is quite interesting because we have learned since then that side effects are probably much more common than we learned from the clinical trials.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there may actually be many reasons behind that. If you look, for example, we've learned lately that statins appear to increase the risk of developing diabetes.
Yep.
And there was a publication a few weeks back from Finland, which where they had studied a high number of men with the it's a Finnish metabolic syndrome follow-up observational trial study, and they actually found that men with the metabolic syndrome who were taking statins had a much higher risk of diabetes compared to those who were not taking statins. And they actually adjusted for confounding factors and everything like that. But what I found interesting with this particular paper was that the curves, it took time for them to separate. It was after, it took a couple of, maybe 2 or 3 years to see that statins appear to be causing diabetes. And that may be one of the reasons that we missed this in the initial clinical trials, because they usually take much shorter time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that statins are very important drugs for us still today, and I think they have helped us a lot, and they have improved our care of patients with cardiovascular disease. And I see statins still as important drugs for people with established cardiovascular disease after a heart attack or after a stroke or in these situations. And but I'm much more aware of it today that they may have side effects, and we have to take that into consideration, because these side effects can actually balance out the positive effects. So in people without cardiovascular disease, we have a completely different picture, because their risk of cardiovascular events is of course much lower than the risk for people who have established disease. So if the total risk is low, the benefit of statin therapy will be much lower. And if we are going to treat a high fraction of the population with statins, we are going to see a lot of side effects. And I believe so. And I think we are seeing them more and more. We know that the muscle pain side effect is probably the most common, but there are also cases where this may become much more severe, with breakdown of muscles and muscle damage, and then we have the thing with diabetes and cognitive function, and there are several side effects that can be problematic. We still may not have learned about them all. Mm-hmm. So I do use statins very carefully in primary prevention. I do, however, think that there are individuals with very high risk who may benefit from them in primary prevention. But I try to educate my patients about statins, and people usually want to participate in a discussion. Some people have made up their minds already. Some say, I don't want to take a drug, and they are very determined about it. And then you have other individuals who say, if you have a drug that can lower my cholesterol number, I'll take it. So that's people look at these issues very differently. But it is about shared decision making, actually.
Great. I think that's a really good point to finish on, is that sometimes, I guess, doctors don't always have the time to educate their patients, and that's not their own fault. That's just the fault of the system that they work in and the number of people they have to see and the amount of work they have to do. So maybe it's kind of on the patient to get out there and educate themselves and maybe do something like read your blog, Axel, which I think is, which has a huge amount of information that's laid out very easily for people to understand. And you often sort of cover the latest studies and kind of give a sort of a broad idea of how people can manage their own disease risk without maybe having to resort to a statin or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. I think we've just hit an hour. That's normally the point where my mum stops listening. So we should probably stop. It's been great, Axel. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you both. Very. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure. And hope somebody will listen to all this stuff.
Oh, well, I hope so. Some people are listening. But we will, so in the show notes of all the podcasts, I try and put lots of information, some extra studies, things we didn't get to talk about. I'll put a link to your blog, Axel, which is docsopinion.com. And then from there, people can always sort of ask questions and we'll sort of see if there's any sort of information that people are missing or they'd like answered, and we'll go from there. So as ever, I've been Tommy Wood. You'll find me on drragnar.com and Chloe Archard on the other side of the line, paleo-britain.co.uk. We'd love to hear what you think of us, particularly of Axel's work, which I'm a big fan of. And we'll see you next time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.